Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Monica Brady Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Chinese government has imposed a nighttime curfew after 2 days of ongoing violence in the western city of Urumqi. At least 150 people have died in the unrest between the Muslim Uyghur minority and the country's majority group, Han Chinese. The ethnic riots started as peaceful demonstrations to protest the deaths of Uyghur factory workers in another clash, this one in the southern part of China. Uyghurs are a Turkic people, mostly Muslim, and they live in the western province of Xinjiang. Many of them have never accepted Chinese rule over their region. Joining us from Urumqi is Wall Street Journal reporter Shai Oster. Shai, it's night there now, but what's been happening all day?
Today, there's been a remarkable turning of the table, so to speak. The majority, or the Han population here, essentially armed themselves with sticks, rebar, meat cleavers and whatnot, and in some cases just defend themselves. In other cases, they went looking for revenge among the Uyghur groups, in some cases just clashing with Uyghurs, in some cases clashing even with the police on their way to try to get to the Uyghurs.
And I've been seeing pictures of the riots. It looks like it's street level, as you say, with sticks and knives, not guns. What about the authorities who are trying to control this? Are they armed?
They appear to be armed, yes. But mostly during the confrontations, the ones on the front line are carrying batons and shields, and they're helmeted and wearing body armor. I've seen plenty of military police, or armed police, and I think some soldiers carrying what appear to be light machine guns, and in some cases shotguns, pistols and whatnot.
How severe is this violence? Is it as serious as Tiananmen Square for the authorities?
The numbers appear to be less, but in some ways it's a different kind of violence. It's a different problem. I mean, Tiananmen Square was not an ethnic unrest issue with the group demanding to separate from the motherland. And so this isn't a collapse of faith in the system. This is a group of people who probably never had faith in the system. But it is a serious problem nonetheless. I mean, this is the worst violence probably of any sort since Tiananmen Square, and among the most violent of the ethnic tensions. It's interesting that China has a constant simmering ethnic tension. It has over 50 ethnic minorities, most of whom are almost completely assimilated. But every now and then, different groups will react violently, but really never to this scale.
Yes, and Tibetans were protesting last year. Tell us a little bit about this region, western China, that borders Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, and it's an area that's really rich in oil and minerals, but has been experiencing a lot of population growth recently. Is this what spurred on some of the ethnic unrest?
Xinjiang literally means new territories, and that kind of gives you a clear sense of it. In some ways, this is an area that's been off and on under Chinese rule for way back when as part of the Silk Road, and it's always been kind of difficult to control. You know, along the Silk Road, you see old garrison towns. It's a desert region surrounded by high mountains. To the south is Tibet. To the north, you get Russia and Mongolia. It's very harsh, but it also has some of the most rich, not only from natural resources, but also enormous cotton plantations. Fruit is grown here as well. The Chinese have been encouraging the Han to settle here since the 50s, and certainly since the 60s, and then further on, in part as a way to further establish control of the region, in part to deal with their own overcrowding problems, and also to reclaim more land. But similarly, it's also been encouraging the local Uyghurs to go find work elsewhere where there are more jobs. But it's despite all of this, and even though Xinjiang itself is clearly, I was here 10 years ago, and I can tell you that it is clearly a richer city than it was 10 years ago. But despite that, these ethnic tensions continue. And if you consider the people rioting in the factories in Guangdong, they were among the upwardly mobile. They were the young guys going out and getting a good job. They weren't the poor and oppressed. But here in Urumqi, some of the old Uyghur neighborhoods are among some of the poorest neighborhoods I've seen in China, and probably in my travels around the world, really kind of grinding poverty of half-naked children running barefoot across open gutters, which is surprising because that sort of poverty has been largely left behind in the bulk of China.
Going back to the unrest, do we know anything about the victims, who they were, and who killed them?
Well, that's a hard question. It's an important question, and it hasn't been fully answered. And I've tried to get into a hospital and have been barred by guards. But it appears to be mostly Han, at least in the initial violence of Sunday night. And it looks like, from talking to both Uyghur and Han witnesses, was sort of off as a peaceful protest, for some unknown reason, just degenerated into violence. And people were killed in the most brutal fashion. I myself saw bricks covered in blood lying next to dried pools of blood. I spoke to people who described seeing people being pulled out of cars. It was a very hands-on kind of violence of the most naked and raw sort. But I've also heard, conversely, Uyghur saying that they saw the Chinese authorities shooting at the Uyghur protesters. The people I spoke to didn't see anybody die of bullet wounds, but they did say they saw and heard shots. So the question we still don't know is, does the tally so far released reflect all the injured from both sides, all the killed from both sides, or is there, in fact, another number of just the Uyghur protesters who were killed?
And the Chinese are blaming outside groups, the Uyghur American Association, and especially the head of that group, for fomenting this unrest and violence in China. Do you see any evidence of that?
The Uyghurs that I spoke to said, oh, you know, the kids, they love looking online and reading about this stuff. But everyone really talked about what happened in the factory in Guangdong. And also everyone described the protest as initially peaceful. Everyone that I spoke to was initially peaceful, and that it was sort of people were making a point about this. I haven't seen any direct evidence, but then again, I don't read Turkic, so I can't say. It's also very strategically important for the Chinese to blame this on outsiders, because if you're not blaming it on somebody from the outside, then your problem is that you hate your neighbor. In other words, if it's an outsider problem, that means that, well, everybody else is okay, even though they're Uyghur. But if it's not an outsider, that means that all the Uyghurs are really bad and hate us.
And how is the Chinese government trying to control the message? We hear that internet services have been cut or slowed down.
I'm in the one room, excuse me, it's two conference rooms in a business center on the third floor of one hotel. This is the only place I'm aware of in this city where you can have internet access. My BlackBerry does not work. Even sending a photo via cell phone does not appear to work. My cell phone link itself is very spotty at best. In fact, the government has come out and said that it has cut internet access into Urumqi.
Just really trying to cut everything off.
What's confusing, though, on the mixed messages, on the one hand, they've limited journalists to two rooms in which to file all their stories. On the other hand, they let us come here. I was harassed, I was frisked by police, armed police, and then later detained for a couple of hours. But even that sort of counts as a step forward compared to several years ago, where this sort of incident would have been completely shut down. Journalists would have been detained at the airport and sent packing. We're allowed here. It's tough. It's inconvenient. I'm spending most of my time walking around because most of the roads are shut down. But the fact remains that they've allowed us here.
Shai, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Shai Oster is the Wall Street Journal reporter in Urumqi, China. President Obama wrapped up his two-day visit to Russia with an appeal to young Russians. He spoke to the graduating class of the New Economics School in Moscow.
You get to decide what comes next. You get to choose where change will take us. Because the future does not belong to those who gather armies on a field of battle or bury missiles in the ground. The future belongs to young people with an education and the imagination to create. That is the source of power in this century.
Before that speech, the president spoke with Prime Minister Vladimir Putin and held a final session with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. The BBC's diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus joins us from Moscow. And Jonathan, the last item on President Obama's agenda in Moscow was a meeting with some opposition leaders. Who did he meet with?
Well, he met with a number of groups, not least the former chess master, Garry Kasparov. It's interesting because this followed meetings with a range of other non-governmental organizations. Obviously, the effort very much today, if yesterday was about grand strategy, arms control, the broad issues of foreign policy, today very much focused on Russia, on trying to connect with the Russian people and Russian society. And obviously, that creates a certain sensitivity with the existing Russian leadership. It had been hoped, for example, that Russian President Mr. Medvedev would have been at this non-governmental organization meeting with Mr. Obama. Not surprisingly, perhaps, the Russians declined and they just got one president.
Well, how do you think Obama did communicating directly with the Russian people?
I think it was a slightly flatter speech, perhaps, than some of his recent grand occasions. One thinks back to the speech in Cairo. Nonetheless, it was interesting. I mean, it set out some of the bullet points of the foreign policy agenda that he and the Russians have agreed upon here. But it also stressed very much common values. He rather elegantly tried to point the Russians, if you like, in the right direction. He said obviously it wasn't his business to decide and determine Russia's national interests, but he used his own experience as a man of African-American parentage. He used the experience of America's own history to stress that without things like the rule of law, a free and independent press and so on, Russia wasn't likely to develop in ways which would improve prosperity for all its citizens.
Well, the summit mainly focused on nuclear arms control. What didn't get addressed at this meeting?
You can't do everything in a short period of time. I mean, the real test of whether even a partial reset of this relationship is going to be achieved is going to come in the weeks and particularly the months ahead. I thought in a way something that looked fairly boring, but I think is perhaps interesting as a sign of the times, this bilateral presidential commission that was established, which covers a very wide agenda, to try and institutionalize the relationship between the two countries at the highest level. It's kind of interesting because if you think back to the early 1990s, there was a very similar institution at the time of Presidents Clinton and Yeltsin, the Gore-Chernomyrdin Commission, I think it was called. That too was aimed at having a broad-ranging agenda, institutionalizing ties between the two countries. Clearly, as the Clinton years wore on, discussion and stress on human rights abuses in Russia, and of course the NATO bombing of Russia's ally Serbia led to a very serious fraying of the relationship. But I think clearly the process has been started.
BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus in Moscow, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure, thank you.
Before we take a break, let's turn to Marshall Goldman, senior scholar in the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. Marshall, just one quick question here. Jonathan Marcus seems to be saying there's a bit of a thaw in U.S.-Russian relations. Do you agree?
It's certainly been a change. If you go back just a year ago, the Russians were at war with Georgia, and we were very critical of that. We were talking about installing missiles in Poland. The Russians were very upset with that. It was a very different kind of climate, a very hostile climate, despite the fact that the two leaders, Bush and Putin, and George W. Bush and Putin, were very close. Our policies were very divergent.
That's Marshall Goldman of Harvard University. We'll hear more from him in a minute about President Obama's trip to Moscow. And later in the show, we'll look at the future of local television news now that some stations are sharing video. Back after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Marshall Goldman, senior scholar in the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. We're talking about President Obama's visit to Russia. Before the break, you said you believe the climate between the U.S. and Russia is improving, that President Obama is reaching out to Russia. But Russia is also changing. It's going to allow the U.S. to use its airspace to send troops and weapons to the war in Afghanistan. What are the implications of that?
Well, the Russians, you know, are very nervous about the fact that it would be like a Trojan horse being brought through the country, and they didn't know what was inside, and they were worried that some of the weapons that we would be bringing might be dropped off to revolutionary groups. You know, when they're paranoid and suspicious, anything could happen. And this, you know, we have had incidents before where we really have abused some of the privileges that we had. And so the Russians saying, okay, we trust you now, and we're letting you do this. This makes it much easier for us to conduct the war in Afghanistan. And I think one of the reasons why the Russians did it is they themselves have a fear of what would happen if conditions in Afghanistan went wrong.
One of the biggest things to come out of the summit is the agreement by both countries to reduce their nuclear stockpiles. How is this a good start going forward, and how significant is this?
Well, I think it is important to go forward this way, because the problem is that in December the START agreement expires. The START agreement had to do with limiting nuclear weapons on both sides, and so we could each go back and start building up our arsenals again. So it was important to reach some kind of agreement to say, look, as a minimum, we're going to hold where we are, and then set themselves some goals to reduce it in the future. So that's positive. In addition to which, this is a way of uniting the United States and Russia in their dealings with Iran and North Korea. And that's there the Russians have leverage that we don't have. And it looks like Obama's got the Russians to agree to help us in this effort to limit that. And that, for me, that's probably the most positive thing to come out of the whole summit meeting.
So you think it sends a strong message to North Korea and Iran?
It certainly sends a strong message. Whether they're going to lie down and say, okay, do whatever you want, we'll do whatever you want us to do, it won't be so easy to see. They probably will still resist, but at least they know that they can't fall back on the Russians to give them either explicit or even unconscious support this way, because the Russians are going to be very critical. And that's very important.
What about the issues that still divide Russia and the United States? The missile defense system the U.S. wants to locate in Poland and the Czech Republic, or NATO membership for Georgia. Was there any progress made on these issues?
It certainly doesn't seem to be on the surface. Frankly, I'm a bit surprised that Obama is holding out to this whole idea of installing missiles in Poland, which was an idea of George W. Bush's administration. And maybe that he's just doing it as a bargaining tool. He wants to hold it so that the Russians say, well, okay, we'll give you this in order to get rid of those missiles. When it comes to Georgia and Ukraine, that's a much harder problem, because this we recognize that those were two parts of the former Soviet Union, but we also recognize and say that they have a right to make up their own minds where they want to go, and if they want to join NATO, they should be able to join NATO. But for the Russians, this really looks like the United States is interfering in their backyard. It would be as if the Russians went to Canada and the Canadians, for some reason, or Mexico, decided that they wanted to join in the Warsaw Pact or something. They wanted to join up with what Russia was trying to do. We would be nervous, and the Russians feel that that's what, in effect, what we're trying to do to them.
Well, President Obama spoke to graduates at the new economic school in Moscow, and I'm wondering a little bit more about that school, what it's promoting. Is it related to the Chicago School of Economics? What does this mean for Russia? And in addition, I read in the interview Obama gave to an opposition newspaper, he took a lot of blame for the state of the world economy.
Well, this new school of economics is really a brand new phenomenon of the post-Soviet era. It's an attempt to introduce Western economics. I mean, after all, in the Soviet era, everything was based around Marxist economics, Marxist understanding. So this is an attempt to bring what we would say, I wouldn't call it capitalist economics, but just economic studies, objective economic
studies. Free market studies?
Yeah, free market studies. But more than that, because you could also talk about planning, but you can approach it from a Western perspective without having an ideological component in there. And it's funded in good part by George Soros and other philanthropists, just like you go to a foundation, you get money this way. And a lot of their economists, a lot of their students have come to school, then go on to school and graduate school in the United States. I mean, it's viewed as that kind of level. And at the same time, some American economists go there and teach. Some Russian economists come here and teach. So it's really considered world class, like the University of London or the London School of Economics. So this is really, he picked this site just, I think, for that reason, that he would find an audience that would not be ideological, that would really understand what he's talking about. What I think he was trying to convey is that the world has a problem with recession, so that there is room for the United States and Russia to cooperate here as well. we've had some experience, not always good, but we've had some experience in dealing with recessions. And what he was trying to get at, I think, was the notion that maybe the United States can help Russia in this respect, just like we think the Russians can help us in dealing with terrorism. So this, I think, was, you know, kind of an interesting venue to hold this discussion. And the accusation that we caused the world economic crisis was an interesting development, because this is what Putin was basically saying. It's all your fault in the United States. And this was kind of a throwback to the old days, whenever you have a disease, it was somebody else who brought it on you. I think this is what Russians, and in this case Putin, were failing to do, is to look to their own problems. Certainly, we, you know, what was going on in the United States did have worldwide ramifications. But it also turns out that the Russians weren't doing what they should have been doing in addressing their own diversification of their own economy. Putin's too heavily reliant on commodities. Russia's too, almost 80-90% of GDP is dependent on that. And so Putin saw that, to his credit, but he could say we've got to diversify, but when it came actually to action, it's not happening. So they have to bear some of that blame themselves.
Marshall Goldman is a senior scholar in the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Monica.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a user's guide to getting health insurance if you're on your own and not part of a group. Hint number one, read the fine print. That's tomorrow. Back after the news, you're listening to Here and Now. This may not be the best of times to launch a new auto company, but that's what we'll get 2 days from now, sort of. On Thursday, General Motors and the Obama administration will close a deal on the automaker's emergence from bankruptcy. The wheels were set in motion earlier this week when a federal bankruptcy judge approved the sale of GM's most valued assets, including Chevy and Cadillac. The brands will form the foundation of a new, streamlined, and the White House hopes improved GM. The U.S. government will own 60% of the restructured automaker. Joining us is Micheline Maynard. She covers the auto industry for the New York Times and joins us from the studios of WDET Radio in Detroit. And Mickey, the lead sentence in your story today reads, "That didn't take long. GM only went into bankruptcy on June 1st. So how did it get out in less than 45 days?
Monica, it's an amazing story, and I think law schools and lawyers all over the country are sort of flabbergasted by this. The essential reason why this moved so quickly is that you had the government involvement. If this had been a private bankruptcy, it could have certainly taken months and even years for this to come to a conclusion.
So what will be the difference then between the old and the new GM? What will this new company look like?
That's a good question. One thing that an Obama administration official said to me is that there's three pieces to this. There's the piece of getting General Motors restructured. There's the piece of GM getting rid of operations it doesn't want to keep. And now there'll be the piece of GM coming out of bankruptcy and hopefully being successful in the auto industry. One of the things that they're doing is getting rid of brands like Pontiac and Saturn and Hummer and Saab. And they're going to be a much smaller company. They're getting rid of factories, and they're also getting rid of a lot of employees. So it's kind of General Motors has had a once-in-a-lifetime chance to shed all the things that it said were keeping it back and go forward.
So it will have a new lease on life, but can it win back automobile buyers as fast as it moved through the bankruptcy court?
One of the things that has happened while this has been going on is the auto market is not recovering, and it's actually reshaping itself. I recently did a story about how the smaller names in the auto business, like Hyundai and Kia and some of the German manufacturers, are doing pretty well because they're not in bankruptcy. They don't have clouds over their head. They've actually been able to pick up market share in the shrunken car market. And market share is very important because you want to keep hold on your piece of the market so that when you come out, you can grow as the market grows.
And I understand GM's market share has fell below 20%, a far cry from the 50% share it had at its peak in the 1960s.
That's right. General Motors, at one point, I think in 1954, they had 54% of the car market. They're down below 20%. And with getting rid of these brands, they'll be shrinking a little bit more. Our market is kind of turning into Europe, where nobody has a giant amount of market share and everyone fights for every sale.
Well, what will this new GM have going for it as it tries to attract new customers?
Well, it will have a much more competitive labor contract. There are new labor contracts with the United Automobile Workers Union. It doesn't have the burden of what are called legacy costs, the big health care and pension costs that it had in the past. It will still pay its pensions, but health care will be covered now by a new fund that actually will be one of the biggest shareholders in General Motors. So it's the structure of General Motors has changed. The size of General Motors has changed. The question is, can people look at this new company and be willing to buy its vehicles?
And Mickey, finally, you write that the speed of the GM bankruptcy deal sent heads spinning in the legal community. It'll probably be topic number one at many law schools. But do you think it means we're seeing a shift in bankruptcy law?
We have already seen a shift in bankruptcy law. It used to be that when you filed for Chapter 11 reorganization, you did just that. You took what you had, you renegotiated contracts, you closed down a few factories, and you reopened as a sort of smaller, leaner business. This has used something called Section 363 of the Bankruptcy Code, and it allows you to sell good assets into a brand new company. That's why it moved so quickly, because we didn't have to redo General Motors top to bottom. We just took the good stuff and put it into a new company. And so I think law schools will be looking at this over the next few years. It had been shifting that way in bankruptcy law to use Section 363. So with these big companies doing it, we'll see even more of it.
Micheline, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Monica. Thank you.
Micheline Maynard covers the auto industry for the New York Times. And coming up, TV newsrooms are sharing photographers and equipment. It might help the bottom line, but what does it mean for the product? Back in 30 seconds, here and now. If you've watched local TV news recently, you may have found yourself doing a double take, wondering if the video you saw on one station was the same footage you just saw on another. That's because news stations in several cities have begun to share video to save money. In some cases, the stations form a local news service, an independent organization that draws staff from each station and then feeds video out to everyone. In other cases, it's more of an informal arrangement. We're going to look at what these collaborations mean for local TV news, first with Ron Stover. He's a videographer for CARE TV, the NBC affiliate in Minneapolis. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you doing today, Monica?
I'm good. How does this video sharing work with stations in your market?
Well, basically, what the assignment desks do every morning is contact each other by phone, decide upon what stories may be of interest to everyone. Generally, these are stories that are brought to their attention by way of a press release, and they will then communicate with each other to find out if everybody is indeed interested in covering a particular story, and that way they can then pool their resources by sending just one photographer to shoot for all four affiliates in our market instead of sending four different photographers from each one.
So these are mainly pressers, ribbon-cutting ceremonies, things where you don't expect something shocking to happen.
Yes.
And how much video are you sharing, say, on a daily basis?
At first, we were trying to do it almost every day, but usually now it's around three times a week. And they will generally go out and just do one story. Once in a while, it may be two.
What do you see as the positives of this arrangement?
Well, the positives would be the fact that they can now free up three other photographers from the other TV stations to go out and cover other news. And with the cutbacks in both personnel and budget, that has been the driving force behind it.
Well, so far you've mainly covered non-competitive stories. What happens if this collaboration grows and stations start sharing video for breaking news? Do you have any concerns that that would hurt competition?
Well, it certainly is a competitive business. Sometimes we do pool up to cover certain events that could be considered breaking news, sometimes in the event of a court hearing where you need to be able to cover more than one entrance or exit from a courthouse to get the shots of the people that you need pictures of. And sometimes we will pool those efforts. But generally in a spot news situation, it's kind of every man for himself, as it always has been.
You said that by collaborating on these resources, it frees up photographers to do other stories.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of other stories are they doing? Are they doing enterprise reporting, or are they just covering more press conferences and ribbon cuttings?
It opens them up to be able to cover whatever the news of the day is. It just improves the number of resources that we have. It allows them to be able to cover more stories than they normally would be able to, because now they have the ability to send those photographers who would have been assigned to that story elsewhere.
Well, where do you think this collaboration is going?
We've only been doing it for a few months. It's very much in an experimental phase. The test is in time.
That's Ron Stover, a videographer for CARE TV in Minneapolis, talking about how stations in his area are sharing news video. Thanks for joining us, Ron.
Well, thank you, Monica.
We now turn to Deborah Potter, the head of News Lab, a broadcast training and research center in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And Deborah, how widespread is this practice of sharing video?
Well, it's growing by leaps and bounds. I'd say we're up to about a dozen markets that I'm aware of, fairly large and medium-sized markets. But I've talked to news managers in much smaller communities that are also talking about the possibility of sharing video.
Economics are at the root of this. Can you give us an overview of what sort of cutbacks are happening that's leading to these collaborations?
Well, we've seen a lot of cuts in staff, particularly higher paid staff, and cutbacks also in some newscasts. There are stations across the country reducing the number of hours of news they do, particularly in those time slots that were recently added, such as weekend morning newscasts. So it's across the board some restructuring, not only because of economic issues, but obviously because of the way people consume news. A lot of news being consumed now on the internet, fewer viewers means lower rates from advertisers. It becomes kind of a downward spiral.
Well, videographers don't just shoot video. They often are the first ones to the scene, and they have their own contacts and approach to filming stories. Could that lead to some problems?
Well, I think you've just put your finger on one of the dilemmas, and that is when there's no competition in the field, when only one photographer is there, there's really no incentive to do any sniffing around or digging. Whatever you would learn, you would have to share with the competition, and that's probably not a positive. So I think it will probably limit the amount of reporting that that photojournalists do when they're at various events. They have contacts, as you point out. They're the first person on the scene in many cases, and they could, if operating independently, develop leads and find out news that isn't being made behind a microphone or a podium at a prearranged event. So I think that is one potential cost. And it's one of those things we may never know because we won't know what we didn't hear. It's going to be interesting to see whether the photographers who get sent out on these assignments are the less experienced, maybe not as able to do excellent work in the field, and whether that will also degrade the quality of what's obtained from these pool assignments.
So for news consumers watching local TV news, we might not be getting everything we could be getting.
Correct. But the other thing is that, one of the questions raised about this entire issue of video sharing is, will it lead to more sameness on the air? The truth is, newscasts are a lot the same anyway. And one of the concerns would be if it becomes easier and easier to cover staged events like press conferences or news conferences or hearings or that sort of thing, will that begin to dominate the news even more than it already does?
Well, where do you think these collaborations could lead? We've seen the story count in newspapers shrink as newspapers rely more on the Associated Press. So if you pick up the Boston Globe, you may see the same stories as you do in the LA Times or the New York Times. It's basically the shrinking pie of news content. And it sounds as if some of this could move right to the local TV news scene.
Well, it could. And I think that's one of the things that those of us who follow the news media will have to keep an eye on. I also think that it's important for viewers of television to speak up when they notice things that don't seem quite right. There's one thing that we know about managers in television stations, and that is they do respond to the bottom line. If they get the sense that this kind of activity is going to lose them viewers and therefore money, I suspect they'd pay attention. So I always hearken back to an old book that was written by a former chairman of the FCC, and the title was How to Talk Back to Your Television Set. And I think that consumers of news ought to be talking back now, and there are lots of ways to do that that they didn't used to have.
Hit that email button. Click here.
You got
send
it.
Your comments. Deborah Potter is the head of News Lab, a broadcast training and research center. She recently wrote about the trend of local TV news stations sharing video for the American Journalism Review. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show anytime on our website, or you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's at hereandnow.org. And before we go today, everything you didn't learn in school about the nation's highest court. You're listening to Here and Now. Confirmation hearings begin Monday for President Obama's first Supreme Court pick, Sonia Sotomayor, and Republicans are expected to bring up as many damaging details as possible about Sotomayor. Well, a look back at the lives and legal opinions of Supreme Court justices reveals some eyebrow-raising details. Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish justice, was so despised by anti-Semitic fellow justice James Clark McReynolds that McReynolds would leave the chamber whenever Brandeis spoke from the bench, and he refused to be photographed with Brandeis. Clarence Thomas once played basketball with Charles Barkley at the justice's private top-floor basketball facility known as the highest court in the land. Thurgood Marshall was a soap opera addict, William Rehnquist was at one time addicted to Valium, and the retirement of Justice William Brennan inspired this 1991 song from the band Fugazi. Justice Brennan, I know it's not your fault. Well, joining us from New York City is Robert Schnackenberg, author of the book Secret Lives of the Supreme Court, What Your Teachers Never Told You About America's Legendary Justices. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Well, I looked up the bios of the sitting Supreme Court justices, and they are pretty boring. They were married here. They received their degree there. It's all about their studies. And your book is anything but boring. How did you find this material? I mean, how did you find out that John Paul Stevens was once one of the top squash players? Or that, well, it might be obvious that Sandra Day O'Connor has vanity plates on her car reading USSC 102. But some of these facts are pretty obscure, especially about the older justices.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a greater quantity of obscure facts about the older justices just because so many biographers have sort of picked over the bones of their careers. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of the biographies of Supreme Court justices are quite dry and tedious and are not meant for a lay audience, but in them are nuggets of these sort of quirky facts and things that you could never believe these people were into or did or were a part of, like Hugo Black being in the Klan and all this stuff. So it's just a matter of finding these little nuggets in the various biographies that exist and bringing them together in one place.
Well, your book has a lot of nuggets. We learn about the legal minds and their personal lives, including the sex lives of some of the justices. And we learn that in the early days of the U.S. Supreme Court, they lived in a dorm together and they seemed to drink a lot.
Yes, it was quite the animal house atmosphere in the early days of the court. This was Chief Justice John Marshall's great innovation was to have them all live together in a boarding house. And at one point, they resolved that they would only drink on days when it was raining. At one point, Marshall ordered Justice Story to go over to the window and see what the weather was so that they could, you know, pop open their bottles of rum. And Story looked out the window and he said, you know, there's not a cloud in the sky. And Marshall said, well, Justice Story, that's about the dumbest, most illogical opinion I've ever heard. You forget that our jurisdiction is as broad as the Republican. And by God, it must be raining somewhere, so bring on the whiskey.
Yeah, a number of justices love their drink, it sounds like. In the 20th century, Wild Bill William O. Douglas, he was the longest-serving justice in Supreme Court history, sometimes wrote opinions on the back of a cocktail napkin, and you call him the horniest man ever to sit on the Supreme Court. Well, what was his story?
He was a bit of a rake. He was constantly under threat of impeachment from his political enemies. In part because he was such a ladies' man. He was quite the time cat. He would go after anything that would wear a skirt, as someone said.
Well, nowadays, the Supreme Court really seems much tamer. Many of the justices they exercise regularly. They seem to eat really well. You note John Paul Stevens has a single grapefruit for lunch every single day. Is this a reflection of the times?
Well, I think so. I think Sandra Day O'Connor helped bring in a fitness regimen when she started the regular jazzercise classes, and I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg does Pilates with her, so it's a much healthier court than probably it used to be when Thurgood Marshall was eating a raw steak for lunch every day.
But these are important legal minds as well, and some listeners are no doubt thinking right about now, hey, who cares about what their personal lives were like? Who cares that William Rehnquist dated O'Connor briefly at Stanford Law School, which really did happen? When they're deciding on such important legal precedents, do we really need to know these things?
Well, do we need to or do we want to? I mean, I think we live in a celebrity culture, and I think you know, one of the conceptual frames I used when I was writing the book is to kind of look at the lives of these folks as if they were ordinary celebrities, you know, kind of ignore the robes and the trappings of eminence and subject them to the kind of scrutiny they would receive if they were, you know, Lindsay Lohan being examined by TMZ or Perez Hilton. I think that's one way of looking at them that can make them more approachable to a lay reader. I also had in mind, there's a quote that you often see attributed to Kurt Vonnegut to the effect that, you know, high school is the closest to the core of the American experience than anything else I can think of, which when you look at a small elite community like Supreme Court justices, you see that that's really true. I mean, every type that you would see in high school is represented on the court. You have the geeks, the jocks, the class brains, right wing, left wing. They all fight and feud with each other, sometimes over the most trivial things. Some of them are racists. Some of them are snobs. So it's really a cross-section of what you would find in the general population. It's just that these people happen to have big brains and elite degrees, and they sit on the highest court in the country.
And as your book makes clear, this is true throughout history. It's not just, you're not talking about present-day court. Over time, some of these personalities and opinions really clashed, and it makes me wonder how these justices can work together when they're so different.
Well, I mean, I think there's a collegiality. I think they can work together. We see on the current court that, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia are great friends, and they actually spend New Year's Eve together, you know, every year doing, you know, kind of potluck dinners, and they share a love of opera. So I think they sort of focus on the things that they might have in common, and the Supreme Court is really just like any other workplace when you get right down to it. There's less of a clash of personalities than there used to be when, you know, everyone hated Brandeis or everyone hated Frankfurter or, you know, McReynolds hated everyone who was Jewish.
Yeah, and looking at Brandeis for a moment, you note he was a member of the still-existing Society for Apprehending Horse Thieves in Dedham, Massachusetts, and he had a bruising four-month confirmation battle in which critics questioned his judicial temperament. Why is that? And is there anything we can learn about that confirmation battle, especially heading into Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation coming up?
Yeah, one of the first of the great confirmation battles was the Stop Brandeis campaign, which was actually led by William Howard Taft, who went on to become Chief Justice and served on the court with Brandeis. Brandeis always felt it was because A, he was a leftist, and B, he was Jewish, and they just didn't want a Jewish justice on the court. The campaign actually failed because they really didn't have, there was no smoking gun or, you know, in the case of Clarence Thomas, a smoking Coke can. They couldn't really find anything on Brandeis that they could kind of hold up his confirmation on. And as a result, the Stop Brandeis campaign fizzled out.
So coming to the present day, Chief Justice John Roberts, you know, he's straight as an arrow. And from your book, the only vice I can see that he might have is that he's a chocoholic.
He is a chocoholic, yes. I'm going to let you consider it a vice to have a pet ladybug, which he also has. But, he's a straight arrow with certain oddball tendencies, let's put it that way.
Robert Schnackenberg is author of the book, Secret Lives of the Supreme Court, What Your Teachers Never Told You About America's Legendary Justices. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.